This week saw the birth of the newest nation in the world, the Republic of South Sudan. After centuries of slavery and then colonialism, 55 years ago, Sudan finally won independence from British rule. But the suffering was only just beginning. In our lifetime, Sudan has endured two major protracted civil and religious wars that have seen over 2.5 million people killed. Quite a price for self-determination. And in a few weeks' time, in September, the Palestinian government will seek UN approval to be recognized as an independent sovereign state based on the June 1967 borders with Israel. But the aspirations of the Palestinian people go back even further than Sudan, at least back to 1947 and the UN partition plan, which you can see there. And this is another legacy of British colonialism. But unlike South Sudan, the United States will probably veto that declaration in the UN Security Council. And at the moment, Israel is pressurizing some of the smaller nations in the General Assembly to avoid a two-thirds majority endorsing that declaration. Will that be the end of the Palestinian aspiration for independence? Well, this week we've seen the Freedom Flotilla 2 presently blockaded in Greek ports. They haven't committed any criminal offences. They are not a threat to the Greek authorities. And yet, again, Greece has been pressured into blockading those boats from leaving and delivering humanitarian aid to Gaza. Some see the boats as an existential threat to Israel's existence. The Israel ambassador to Spain, Rafael Schütz, said this week, "There is no humanitarian crisis or shortage of food and medicine in Gaza." He said the Freedom Flotilla should be seen for what it is, a propaganda event intended to build solidarity with a terrorist group that wants to wipe Israel off the map and kill the greatest possible number of Jews and Israelis. Many Jewish people tonight do fear further attempts to annihilate them. And unfortunately, there have been plenty of historical precedents. Comparisons between Ahmadinejad and Hitler are common, even among the WikiLeaked US diplomatic cables. So how should we respond? Clearly, anti-Semitism is evil. Racism is unacceptable and must not be tolerated. But how should we respond to those who threaten Israel's existence? John Hagee is the pastor of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas. He has 20,000 members, and every week he broadcasts on TV and radio into 100 million homes around the world, and he's speaking in Birmingham in a couple of weeks' time. That is, unless the Home Secretary bans his visit. Well, he offers one novel solution to dealing with the enemies of Israel. He said the United States must join Israel in a preemptive military strike against Iran to fulfill God's plan for both Israel and the West, a biblically prophesied end-time confrontation with Iran, which will lead to the rapture, tribulation, and second coming of Christ. So let me ask you a question tonight. What is the difference between a preemptive military strike by Israel against Iran and the preemptive military strike advocated by Esther against Iran 2,500 years ago? Well, let's find out. According to the United Nations, there are 32 armed conflicts going on tonight, which will see at least 1,000 people killed this year The term ethnic cleansing was coined in 1992 during the Bosnian-Serb civil war, but it's clearly been practiced for thousands of years. So when we turn to this final episode in the book of Esther, are we not witnessing the same kind of barbaric, tribal, ethnic cleansing that we see going on tonight in Iraq, in Burma, in Ossetia, in Kashmir, in Indonesia, in Botswana, and the other 32 places in our world where we see armed conflict going on? Well, superficially, yes, there is an element of truth in that, because human nature has not improved since the time of Esther. I don't imagine the Jews and the Iranians of Esther's day were any more righteous than their contemporaries today. And certainly, we are no more righteous than they. But why does the story of Esther have to end in this way, with such slaughter? And we recoil from these numbers killed, 75,000 slaughtered in 2 days. More importantly, some may ask, why is it recorded here in the scriptures? Well, let's find out. I've retitled this, "The Empire Strikes Back." But the question is it a just and proportionate retaliation? It may not be palatable, but the explanation is there in the text. We've reached the penultimate episode in the story of Esther, and I want us to observe the means of Israel's deliverance, the completeness of Israel's deliverance, and the purpose of Israel's deliverance. Next week, James is going to expand the last chapter and summarize the book as a whole and bring it all together, we hope. But for now, let's observe, first of all, the means of Israel's deliverance, the means, verses 1 to 4. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the day of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities and the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them, and all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces and became more and more powerful. If we're looking for an explanation for this deliverance, we see it in the royal authority. The royal authority primarily accounts for this deliverance. But as we've seen every week, behind these momentous events, the recurring theme uncovered on every page is the unseen hand of God. What the world calls coincidence, Christians spell providence. The story of Esther is remarkable for showing us God's providential ruling in human affairs, guiding, protecting, and saving his people. As Matthew Henry says in his commentary, God's unseen hand is clearly at work on every page. But not with a Disney-style fairy tale ending. We see here the raw and the brutal reality of fallen human nature, the means of Israel's deliverance. Secondly, I want you to notice the completeness of Israel's deliverance, verses 5 to 17. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They killed the sons, the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Two questions we want to answer tonight to make sense of this story and perhaps guide us to interpret what's happening today. Israel's deliverance may have been complete, but was the justification, the vindication justified? Was the vindication justified? Well, notice the official authorization for Israel's deliverance. It's explicit. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. I want you to notice that, first of all, this vindication was on the basis of law. It was an edict from the ruling authority, albeit a omnipotent king. Nevertheless, it was due authority. It was not rebellion. It was not a civil war situation. It was not an insurrection. It was due process. It was law. It was from the government. But how can Christians take seriously Jesus when he said, love your enemies, and not feel uncomfortable? Countries blessed with a Judeo-Christian heritage are largely responsible for drawing up the Geneva Conventions, for example, which specify how war may be conducted and explicitly protect the rights of non-combatants, for example, medical personnel, prisoners of war, women and children, possessions. Now, speaking personally, I regret the British Parliament is being coerced at this moment into allowing the government to decide who may be charged with war crimes under the Geneva Convention. Until now, it has been left to the impartiality of judges and lawyers. It is for the due legal process to decide if someone is a war criminal, that is, someone who has committed war crimes, breached the Geneva Conventions. And in our present situation, our Parliament is taking that authority away from the judicial system and leaving it in the hands of the Director of Public Prosecutions. So it will be a political decision as to whether that person is a war criminal because he's a friend of ours, and that person is not a war criminal, or that person is and that person isn't. It will be based on political pragmatism rather than international law. Although it may not have been practiced, it has long been part of the Western heritage that enemies should be treated with kindness. That when enemies become prisoners of war, they should be protected and respected. That civilians should not be regarded as combatants. The 16th century proverb insists the noblest vengeance is to forgive. The noblest vengeance is to forgive. But surely avenging ourselves, however just, is uncivilized. It's primitive. Well, it's essential that we understand and realize that our cultural conditioning, we bring that conditioning to the scriptures and our reading. And therefore we must step outside of our cultural upbringing and understand what God's text, God's word says. And it may be helpful at this point to see how language has changed over time. In the English language, there are two sets of words with a common origin, but with very different meanings. The word avenge and vengeance came into English from the Latin vindicare, but via the French. Okay, so vindicare in Latin became avenge and vengeance, but it came to English through the French language. The word vindicate, which also comes from vindicare, came direct into English from the Latin. So you've got avenge and vengeance and vindicate, and they all come from the same word. But as you'll appreciate, although they have a common ancestry in English and to our ears, they sound very different. The verb to vindicate has commendable overtones. A good judge vindicates the innocent. But the verb to avenge or vengeance has negative connotations. We associate them with emotional reactions prompted by hatred. Now in Esther 8 verse 13, the word translated avenge, the Jews will avenge themselves, doesn't mean personal vengeance or a vendetta. It means justified punishment, even preemptive, in order to avoid greater suffering. So the word avenge in Esther 8 has more to do with vindicate than it does with revenge. It's come from the same root, but that is its meaning. In over half the cases, and in this case, when the word is used in Hebrew, it deals with God's righteous vindication in bringing justice. So what we see here, however bloody, is justice being exacted, not revenge. Okay? We are not witnessing acts of personal grievance or mob rule, but the judicial decision to avert genocide. Think about it. In one single day, the entire Jewish race was going to be wiped out. Their enemies had royal sanction, and they had months to prepare. They had made their lists, chosen their weapons, planned their strategy, decided their locations. They probably even decided how they were going to spend the plunder. But at this critical and decisive moment, God brought deliverance and vindication. The fact that this surprising reversal in their circumstances takes place is awe-inspiring. It points to the providential ordering of their affairs. To be sure, it was wonderful and a cause of rejoicing, but not for arrogance or for presumption. The taking of personal revenge to settle a score would indeed elicit God's punishment. On this occasion, and in these circumstances, there was no other way of dealing with the enemies of God's people. It was indeed going to be complete, but it was justified. But the second question we want to ask is, was this destruction proportionate? Because in the just war theory that has come out of Christian, Jewish-Christian heritage, upon which the Geneva Conventions are based, is this idea of proportionality. Proportionality. The punishment must be proportionate to the crime. So let's have a look. Chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces to attack those determined to destroy them. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. They killed the 10 sons of Haman, sons of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Notice how this was indeed proportionate. First one, the enemies of the Jews, those who hated them, these were the ones who were targeted, those who were determined to destroy them, verse 2. Their enemies, those who hated them, verse 5. The Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, verse 6. The 10 sons of Haman, the enemies of the Jews, verse 10. This preemptive move specifically targeted the sons of Haman, the men who had hated them, those determined to destroy them. And to demonstrate that this was restrained, it was not fueled by the desire for personal gain, verse 10 also tells us they did not lay their hands on the plunder. And if you were reading carefully, you'd have noticed that sentence appears three times in the text. What is the writer saying? The writer is emphasizing that there was no personal gain as a result of this action. True, 75,000 Iranians killed sounds rather a lot of people. But remember, this is less than 10% of the number of Jewish people who were living in Iran at the time. Only 10% of the number of Jews who would have been killed on that same day had God not intervened. Therefore, the number killed was far, far fewer than those who would have been killed a day later. Israel's deliverance, therefore, was complete, it was justified, and it was proportionate. There was no other way around the king's edict other than to issue another edict to proceed and counter the first. So as we've seen, the means of Israel's deliverance, verses 1 to 4. We've seen the completeness of Israel's deliverance, verses 5 to 17. We've answered those two questions. Was the vindication justified? Yes. Was the destruction proportionate? Yes. And as we conclude, let me give you a taster for the concluding episode next week, and we'll conclude with the purpose of Israel's deliverance. Very briefly, three reasons. First observation we can make is that this was in order to ensure that God's people remembered God's saving acts, verses 20 to 22. Mordecai recorded these events. He sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces, far and near, to have them celebrate annually on the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, at the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. We have no difficulty remembering certain dates when we have an incentive to do so. Our birthdays, Christmas, remember the 5th of. Repeatedly through history, God gave his people anniversaries. He gave them feast days and fast days to remember his saving acts. Why? Because without them, we would forget. We'd forget God's goodness. We'd forget God's grace and mercy. So the purpose of Israel's deliverance recorded was so that God's people would remember his saving acts. Secondly, verses 23 to 32, it was in order that God's people would worship. Verse 23, so the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they'd begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. It had begun spontaneously, and that was natural and right. But it was important that the event was recorded and remembered by future generations so that they would continue to be grateful and give thanks to God for his deliverance. And the Feast of Purim, as it's known today, is very popular with Jewish children, partly because they get presents, partly because they get to dress up. But more importantly, they remember this event. It was that God's people would worship. And then finally, it was thirdly, that God's people would learn. Mordecai, the Jew, was second in rank to King Xerxes, prominent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and he spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. This deliverance was in order that God's people would learn from their leaders, from the example of Esther and Mordecai. He was held in high esteem, he worked for the good of his people, and he spoke up for their welfare. In every generation, we look to our leaders for inspiration and direction. And this week, we've seen some in the news media who've fallen short. When critical and tough decisions are needed, we need strong leaders who will act with integrity. Micah 6:8 says, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. It's ironic that today, despite the events we've been reading about in Esther chapter 9, the largest ethnic community of Jews in the Middle East today is in Iran. Outside Israel, there are more Jewish people living in Iran than any other country in the Middle East. And one has to say that presumably they feel safe there. Notwithstanding what Ahmadinejad might wish to do to Israel, the Jewish people have learnt in Iran to trust in God to protect them. There's nothing complicated about being this kind of person God can use. Esther and Mordecai were used so mightily, so providentially by God to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of God's people because they were indeed prepared to act justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with their God. And that is what the Lord requires of you and I this week. Perhaps we can begin to see now why this book has been, for the Jewish people, their ground of hope in the future. They looked for vindication, and in God's time it came. It surely came. The means of Israel's deliverance, the completeness of Israel's deliverance, and the purpose of Israel's deliverance. Without Esther and Mordecai, there would have been no Jewish people today. Without Esther and Mordecai's acts, there would have been no Jewish Messiah today. The providence of God continues to be seen in the survival of God's people today. And it is ironic, surely, that the church is strongest where it is most persecuted. That is why the story of Esther is not only precious for Jewish people, it is part of our history, our heritage, and should strengthen our hope. The question I want to leave you with this evening is this: will we be the Esthers and the Mordecais of our generation? For it is no accident that you are here tonight. It is no coincidence that God has placed you in this church. It is not by chance that God has placed you in your place of work and in your community. God has indeed a purpose for you, a redeeming purpose within his cosmic plan. The question is, do you discern what that purpose is, and are you willing to be part of it? Or will the Lord have to look elsewhere to bring deliverance to others? So Mordecai said to Esther, "Do not think because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, that you and your family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to this royal position for such a time as this."